This is NBC Nightly News, Thursday, June 14th. Reported tonight from Washington by John Chancellor.
Good evening. The news is dominated tonight by one explosive story. A witness at the Senate Watergate hearings today directly implicated former Attorney General John Mitchell in the Watergate bugging and cover-up, and implicated in the cover-up a lot of other people, including the former White House Chief of Staff, H.R. Haldeman. The witness was Jeb Stuart Magruder, a Haldeman assistant at the White House who became number two man at the committee to re-elect the president. Magruder's story began today with a description of an incredible million-dollar plan for political dirty tricks and lawbreaking, a plan proposed to John Mitchell, who was then Attorney General, by G. Gordon Liddy, who was then at the re-election committee. The president's counsel, John Dean, was also at that meeting. Here's Magruder telling about the scope of the plan.
There was, of course, the projects including wiretapping, electronic surveillance, and photography. There were projects relating to the abduction of individuals, particularly members of radical groups. We were concerned about the convention in San Diego. Mr. Liddy had a plan where the leaders would be abducted and detained in a place like Mexico, and that they would then be returned to this country at the end of the convention. He had another plan which would have used women as agents to work with members of the Democratic National Committee and at their convention and here in Washington, and hopefully through their efforts they would obtain information from them.
With regard to the use of these women as agents, did this involve the use of a yacht in Miami?
He envisioned renting a yacht in Miami and having it set up for sound and photographs.
And what would the women be doing at that time?
I really could only estimate, but...
Well, based on his project, as your recollection, what did he indicate in this?
They would have been, I think you could consider them call girls.
Magruder said everyone was appalled by the plan and by its million-dollar cost. Liddy was told to go back to the drawing board. He later got it down to $500,000, but that was still too much. In March of 1971, however, Magruder says the Liddy espionage project was down to $250,000, and Magruder testified under oath today that John Mitchell, by then the president's campaign manager, approved the plan.
We discussed the pros and cons, Mr. LaRue and Mr. Mitchell and I, and there was not any great feeling of acceptance to this plan, with the exception that supposedly these individuals were very professional, the information could be valuable, and that after starting at this grandiose sum of $1 million, that probably $250,000 would be an acceptable figure. I think we all had questions about Mr. Liddy, but he had come with good recommendation, and Mr. Mitchell made some notes on his copies, indicated the targets as we had discussed previously, and Mr. Mitchell simply signed off on it in the sense of saying, okay, let's give him the $250,000 and let's see what he can come up with.
And so Liddy's burglars broke into the headquarters of the Democratic Party and were not caught on that occasion. Summaries of bug telephone calls and photographs of private documents began flowing into John Mitchell's office, according to Magruder's testimony. There was only one flaw, Magruder said today. John Mitchell thought the stuff was worthless.
He, as I recall, reviewed the documents, indicated, as I did, that there was really no substance to these documents. At that time, and as I recall, it was at that time we called Mr. Liddy up to his office, and Mr. Mitchell indicated his dissatisfaction with the results of his work.
Well, did he tell him anything more than he was dissatisfied?
He didn't ask for anything more. He simply indicated that this was not satisfactory, that it was worthless and not worth the money that had been paid for. Mr. Liddy indicated that there was problems with one wiretap and that one was not placed in the proper phone, and that he would correct these matters and hopefully get the information that was requested.
At this point in his testimony, Magruder had fully implicated John Mitchell in these illegal actions. Later, Magruder told of going to Mitchell to say that he had decided to tell the truth, that he would no longer follow the cover-up story. Magruder testified that Mitchell then wished him good luck and said, "You know, I can't go that way. You go your way, and I'll go mine."
NBC Nightly News is brought to you by the house paint that outlasted other best-selling brands more than 9 out of 10 times. DuPont Lucite.
Trouble. Telltale signs of cracking paint. Is there one house paint that resists cracking like this longer than others? Yes, DuPont Lucite. For several years on wooden houses across the country, DuPont has compared Lucite with 5 other leading brands. In 16 comparisons, another paint lasted longer. But in 265, DuPont Lucite lasted longer. Send for test details and see for yourself. Lucite lasts longer.
Well, Susie, how's the new job?
Unreal, Mr. Simmons. My first customer, and she can't make up her mind about a laxative. They're zillions.
Why not recommend the kind I use? Phillips Milk of Magnesia. It's so gentle and yet thorough. And Milk of Magnesia is the laxative doctors recommend most often.
Doctors do?
Sure do.
Well, Mrs. Drummond, I'd recommend Phillips Milk of Magnesia because it's the kind of laxative doctors recommend most. Doctors do?
More now on the biggest day so far in the 11 days of the Senate Watergate hearings. The witness, Jeb Stuart Magruder, who told the committee that John Mitchell had approved a break-in and bugging at Democratic National Headquarters. Magruder, who was then number two man at the committee to re-elect the president, went on to say that after the committee's burglars were caught by the police, there was no question but that an attempt would be made to cover up for the high officials who were involved. Here is Magruder telling why.
Well, I think there was no question that the cover-up began that Saturday when we realized there was a break-in. I don't think there was ever any discussion that there wouldn't be a cover-up. At least I did not participate in any discussion that indicated anything else except that at one point where we possibly thought that I might volunteer to become the key figure in the case.
An historic decision to go forward with this plan was followed with another historic decision to cover it up without any great debate or discussion of the matter.
That's correct, sir. Now, I think, to be fair, Senator, I think at that point in time, you have to realize that, one, I felt, and I can't speak for the others, that the president had no knowledge of this plan. And consequently, if he had been, if it had gotten out and people like Mr. Mitchell and others had been involved at that point in time, I honestly thought that his reelection would be probably negated. Now, at that time, I thought it was the best decision to make.
So an elaborate plan was devised, according to Magruder, to keep the authorities from knowing just who at the reelection committee was really involved. They kept this up for a long period of time. For example, Magruder says he was briefed on lies to tell the grand jury, briefed by John Mitchell and by the president's own White House legal counsel, John Dean, in his White House office. And that is a direct accusation by Magruder of Dean's personal involvement in the conspiracy.
I was aware that I was a target of the grand jury at that time, and so I was briefed by our lawyers, and very normally. Also, I was interrogated for approximately 2 hours by Mr. Dean and approximately a half hour in a general way by Mr. Mitchell.
Now, after you appeared before the grand jury the second time, did Mr. Dean give you any report?
Yes, the day after, Mr. Dean indicated that I would not be indicted.
Did he tell you how he knew that?
No, he did not.
And by the way, again, Mr. Dean's participation, you were aware, were you not, that Mr. Dean worked in the White House and did report to Mr. Ehrlichman and Mr. Haldeman?
Yes, sir. He was in a staff role and did report to the gentleman you mentioned. Consequently, you would assume, and I did not know, and at no time did I know, that he was directly reporting back to either Mr. Haldeman or Mr. Ehrlichman. I did assume this. But that was only an assumption from my work at the White House myself.
There is one intriguing sentence in that part of Dean's testimony, in Magruder's testimony. He said John Dean told him he would not be indicted. It isn't clear from that whether John Dean only believed that Magruder wouldn't be indicted if he told lies to the grand jury, or if he knew that there would be no indictment. In any case, Magruder was not indicted. The next chapter in Magruder's testimony deals with the White House, and we'll have that in a moment.
You're never ready for a tornado, but he is. He's part of State Farm's disaster service team. Specially trained men, ready to go whenever natural disasters strike. He backs up local agents, settles claims on the spot, so State Farm policyholders can get their homes, cars, and lives back together, fast.
And like a good neighbor,
your heart, dry. Your little throat is parched. Wet it down with Nest Tea, all the way down.
T.T. Nest Tea, iced tea.
Here comes 100% tea, ready in an instant. Crisp, clear, never cloudy. Nest Tea even comes already lemoned and sugared. Look out, thirst. Here comes refreshment.
T.T. Nest Tea, iced tea.
Take the plunge.
In his Senate testimony today, Jeb Stuart Magruder implicated a lot of people in the Watergate bugging and the subsequent cover-up, John Mitchell, John Dean, and other campaign and White House aides, including for part of the period of the cover-up, the president's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman. Magruder said repeatedly that he didn't believe President Nixon was involved or had knowledge of what was going on. He said he was told by Mitchell and by Dean that his family would be taken care of if he went to jail, and that both men mentioned the possibility of executive clemency. But Magruder said he thought they weren't really speaking for the president.
During this time, of course, since I knew I was a target of the grand jury, I was somewhat concerned about what would happen to me if I was indicted. So I went through the same type of thing that the other defendants in the trial did and asked Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Dean for the kind of assurances that they did. They made those assurances to me, but they...
What assurances specifically?
Well, they made assurances about income and being taken care of from your standpoint of my family and job afterwards and that type of thing, and also that there would be a good opportunity for executive clemency. But having worked at the White House and being aware of our structure there, I did not take that as meaning a direct relationship to the president at all. In fact, the use of his name was very common in many cases where it was inappropriate. In other words, where he had not had any dealings in the matter. So I knew that this did not necessarily mean it came from the president or anyone else other than Mr. Dean and Mr. Mitchell.
By the end of last year, after the presidential election and before the trial of the Watergate burglars, Magruder says he began to get scared. One reason was that some of the people he named today as co-conspirators were beginning to change their stories. So, he testified, in January of this year, he went to the White House to see Mr. Haldeman because he thought it might be scapegoat time. He says he told everything to Haldeman, including the fact that he was about to commit perjury at the trial of the burglars.
I thought probably that this maybe was becoming scapegoat time and that maybe I was going to be the scapegoat. And so I went to Mr. Haldeman. I said, I just want you to know that this whole Watergate situation and the other activities was a concerted effort by a number of people. And so I went through literally a monologue on what had occurred. And that was my first discussion with Mr. Haldeman, where I laid out the true facts.
Was this conversation with Mr. Haldeman before or after the trial?
It was before the trial, before the inauguration, sometime early in January, after the first of the year.
And your meeting with Mr. Haldeman was before the trial was over?
Yes, sir.
And the story that you told him before the trial was over?
That's correct.
Mr. Haldeman knew that perjury was going to be committed.
Was going to be committed, and of course didn't know that it had been committed until after the trial.
But he did know that perjury was going to be committed.
Yes, I think that would be correct.
Haldeman has mentioned no such meeting with Magruder, although he has described the president then as displaying a new concern that any questions on Watergate be cleared up. And if Magruder's version of that meeting is true, it makes Haldeman, under the law, a party to perjury. In his testimony today, Magruder said that among those who knew what was going on were Frederick LaRue and Robert Mardian, both aides to John Mitchell, and Gordon Strawn, who was Haldeman's assistant in the White House. The Associated Press said this afternoon that Strawn is prepared to testify that he told Mitchell about the cover-up last year, if he is granted immunity. The committee has granted him immunity, but the special Watergate prosecutor, Archibald Cox, has invoked a rule which won't allow Strawn to testify for 30 days.
DAP, America's first name in home fix-up, makes DAP fixer products to fill your every fix-up need. Like Quick Seal, the tub fixer, for watertight seals around tub, shower, and sink. And Panel New, the paneling fixer, to clean and beautify paneling. And DAP Latex Caulk, the smooth-flowing caulk fixer that stops air and water leaks. When you need to fix something inside or outside your house, remember America's first name in home fix-up, DAP. Pfeiffer's new red wine vinegar and oil dressing can startle a salad. With a perfect blend of red wine vinegar and oil, delicately seasoned with onion, garlic, and oregano. Startle your salads with Pfeiffer's new red wine vinegar and oil dressing. It's startling.
The Senate voted overwhelmingly today to forbid any further military action in Indochina, on the ground or in the air. It was the strongest anti-war action ever taken by either house of Congress. The Senate vote was 67 to 15. Even Senator Hugh Scott, the Republican leader, said he will support the bombing of Cambodia only until the end of this month, no longer. In Moscow today, Soviet Communist leader Leonid Brezhnev, who's coming to the United States in a few days, held an unusual news conference. He said Watergate will have no bearing on his talks with President Nixon. And Henry Kissinger, also at a news conference, warned reporters not to expect anything dramatic to come from the Brezhnev-Nixon summit.
The arms race now is fueled not so much by quantitative, but by qualitative changes. Improvements in accuracy, changes in the numbers of warheads on individual missiles, and similar technological changes can have a more profound impact on the strategic balance than a mere change in numbers. We are therefore involved in extraordinarily complex negotiations. We do not expect, indeed, we do not aim for a settlement of these questions at this meeting.
The 60-day price freeze decreed last night by President Nixon went into effect today. There were these developments. The Cost of Living Council predicted price rollbacks in 7 to 9 industries, including chemicals and electrical equipment. The council increased the size of its enforcement staff, but said it is counting on the public also to turn in violators of the freeze. Some economists said the freeze is a good idea. Some thought it isn't, and another group is convinced it's not drastic enough. The decision not to freeze wages was hailed by Labor Secretary Peter Brennan as evidence of President Nixon's concern for working people. But there are misgivings about the presidential decision to freeze retail food prices and not the prices of raw farm products. The people who make bread, the most basic of foods, feel that the freeze could produce shortages. And Rebecca Bell has more on that story.
The cost of bread has never been higher. Even so, the bulk of the baking industry is operating at a loss. The reason is bakers are caught in a price squeeze. Since the Russians began buying U.S. wheat last July, the price of wheat has jumped 80%. The cost of other ingredients and labor is also up, But stiff competition and a federal ceiling have prevented bakers from passing on these dramatic cost increases. The 47-year-old Bakerite Company in Plover, Wisconsin, is now losing $500,000 a year. The company was hanging on, hoping for some price relief, but with the new freeze, there will be no relief. Already, more than 50 independent bakers like Bakerite have gone out of business this year, and many more are threatened. Many bakers are convinced the president's price freeze is disastrous, and some think it could even lead to bread shortages.
It's hard to imagine that the consumer wouldn't be able to buy enough, but that's the only logical conclusion I can see following this type of political expediency and price control that we've seen here tonight.
So in the richest country in the world, at a time when prices for basics like bread and meat have never been higher, the producers, bakers and farmers, are saying they can't make a profit. They're also warning consumers that a fixed price won't be much help if no one's willing to produce at that price. Rebecca Bell, NBC News, Plover, Wisconsin.
The stock markets responded unfavorably today to the price freeze. Trading was light and prices were down. The Dow Jones Industrials fell almost 12 points. On the New York Stock Exchange, the average price of a share lost 42 cents. On the American Exchange, the average price of a share lost 5 cents. European money dealers were not impressed with the freeze either. They called it too little, too late. So the price of gold rose and the value of the dollar went down again. Last night in the Sandia Mountains of New Mexico, 42 people were stranded in two cable cars hundreds of feet above the rough terrain. A cable on what is called the world's longest tramway jumped its track, and there the passengers spent the night. The work of getting the passengers down to safety began last night, and today a number of them were rescued. Here's a report.
10 people were stranded in the lower car for 18 hours before they were finally rescued late this morning by a mountain rescue unit. The efforts began late last night when a crane was brought to the base of the mountain and hauled under the cabin. The crane attempted to lift a cable that had jarred loose during a violent thunderstorm late yesterday afternoon. But the boom on the crane was too short to lift the loose cable back into its guide. It was then decided to lower the passengers out the side of the cabin by use of a special sling.
A little bit. Bring her down now. Out a little. Okay, now come on down.
The first person down was Rosemary Sheldon of Kingsville, Texas. She described the ordeal.
We just got tired of being up there and everything. But other than that, it was just okay.
Was anyone ever afraid?
The only time we got scared was when the lightning storm started yesterday, about 5:30 or 6. After that, it was all us.
And this update from Los Angeles. The other 32 passengers have now been rescued safely from the cable car at the top of the mountain.
Canada today said that it is putting temporary export controls on gasoline and home heating oil beginning midnight tomorrow. The controls are the result of greatly increased exports to the United States, which is struggling with its own fuel shortage. The makers of 10 leading aspirin products today denied Federal Trade Commission charges of false and misleading advertising. The manufacturers advertise that their products are better than plain aspirin, and they insisted today that that is true. Secretary of State Rogers told the Atlantic Alliance Council in Copenhagen today that President Nixon won't make any major deals with Leonid Brezhnev over the heads of the alliance countries. Meyer Lansky, the gangster and financial chief for the underworld, today was sentenced to a year in prison for contempt of a federal grand jury in Miami. He refused to answer questions before the jury, and he will appeal that decision. More reports of White House changes. Texas sources say John Connally, frustrated from being cut off from ready access to President Nixon, is ready to resign his temporary White House post. And Bryce Harlow, who left his post as presidential counselor to become vice president of Procter & Gamble, is returning to the White House. He is taking a leave of absence from the soap company.
You can buy a powder to help keep your feet dry, and you can buy a cooling foot refresher, and you can buy an athlete's foot treatment. Or you can buy Desinex. Desinex does it all. Sprayed into shoes and boots, it helps keep feet dry and comfortable. Sprayed through stockings, it soothes and cools hot, tired, aching feet. And medicated Desinex powder helps relieve itchy, burning, peeling feet. Athlete's foot. Desinex. It does a lot more than just fight athlete's foot.
Black is beautiful. For a colonial house? On second thought, maybe you better go with the white.
Just one of a multitude of colors at your Pittsburgh paints dealer. Oh, I'm sorry. A product of PPG Industries.
Morton Halperin, whose phone was tapped while he was on Henry Kissinger's White House staff, today filed a $600,000 lawsuit against Kissinger and five other people. Halperin's phone was tapped from 1969 to 1971 at a time when some White House staff people felt themselves under siege, especially from anti-war groups. Jeb Stuart Magruder talked about this attitude today at the Senate Watergate hearings. He seemed to be saying that if respectable people in the anti-war movement were breaking laws, it made it easier for White House people to drift into breaking the laws. Here is Magruder describing that atmosphere.
I saw people that I was very close to breaking the law without any regard for any other person's pattern of behavior or belief. And I believed as firmly as they did that the president was correct in this issue. So consequently, and let me just say, when these subjects came up, and although I was aware they were illegal, and I'm sure the others did, we had become somewhat inured to using some activities that would help us in accomplishing what we thought was a cause, a legitimate cause. Now that's absolutely incorrect. Two wrongs do not make a right. For the past year, I've obviously had to consider that, and I understand completely that that was an absolute incorrect decision. But that is basically, I think, the reason why that decision was made, because of that atmosphere that had occurred. And to all of us who had worked in the White House, there was that feeling of resentment and of frustration at being able to deal with issues on a legal basis.
Good night for NBC News.